today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
It's as if we tell somebody about Jesus and who he is and what he's done for them. And it's like, okay, we want you to make a judgment whether or not you're going to yield your life to Jesus Christ. Is it going to be thumbs up to Jesus or thumbs down to Jesus? It's as if Jesus on trial before each individual human heart that hears about him. And I understand that and I get him. But if you were to pan the camera back, who's really on judgment? That individual. You and I are on judgment before Jesus.
The trial of Jesus before he was crucified was certainly a critical point in history. However, in today's teaching, Pastor David shows us how, in a sense, Jesus is still on trial today. He's put on trial in the hearts of all men and women, but it's not up to us to decide if Jesus is the Son of God. He is Lord. We are actually the ones on trial to see whether we'll choose to make him the Lord of our lives. Your verdict will determine your eternal sentence, and a decision must be made today. So, what do you say? Now, here's Pastor David with part two of his message, Witness of Jesus' Betrayer.
As is common in many places in the world, where you're from is betrayed by the way that you speak. And the Galileans had their own accent or dialect or this, and they could tell, well, look, you talk like a Galilean. It would be like somebody with a thick Texas drawl or, you know, a New England accent or something like that. And if Jesus was from Texas or New England, nobody get any ideas about that. But you say, well, of course you're one of his disciples. Look, you talk just like he would. You're from that area. And Peter denies. Isn't it funny? Think of a guy with a very thick Texas accent denying that he ever came from Texas. That's essentially what he's doing in verse 60, where he says, man, I do not even know what you're saying. And as soon as he does that, he does something else. Matthew chapter 26, verse 74 says this, that at the last denial, Peter began to even curse and swear. Look at it here, Matthew chapter 26, verse 74. Then he began to curse and swear, saying, I do not know the man. Well, you know what? If you want to distance yourself from Jesus, if you want to show to other people that you really don't know Jesus at all, cursing and swearing is a pretty good way to do it. It's a pretty good way to see, yeah, I don't even know the guy. I don't have any association with him. That's what Peter began to do. Now notice what happened at the end of it. What do we say? Immediately, while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. Now, you know what? In that culture, in those kind of places, there's always, you know, chickens and roosters running around. It's the most common thing in the world to hear a rooster crow in the morning. Nothing unusual about that. Think about all the hundreds, maybe even thousands of mornings that Peter and others had heard a rooster crow. Think for everybody else around that fire. They heard a rooster crow. So what? What do you think it said to Peter when that rooster crowed? He remembered what Jesus had said. When Peter, in his tremendous self-confidence, said, Jesus, not only will I not deny you, I will die with you. And Jesus says to Peter, you're going to deny me so fast that the rooster's not even going to crow. The alarm clock's not even going to go off in the morning until you deny me three times. And instantly, Peter realized that all his talk, all his bragging, all his pride about what a great servant and devoted follower of Jesus was, it crumbled. Let me ask you right now, can you imagine how broken Peter is at verse 60? Can you imagine how shattered he is? But was he in a good place or a bad place? Friends, it is a painful thing to be broken of our pride, but it is a good thing. It is good. And I don't expect for a moment for Peter to be happy in verse 60. Matter of fact, he was probably never lower in his entire life than he was right then, and deservedly so. But friends, it's a good place to realize, God, you are so right, and I am so wrong. And the high opinion of myself that I once had, it's shattered. What a powerful thing that is. Verse 61, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter. You want a great debating point? Which hurt Peter more, the sound of the cock crowing or the look of Jesus across the courtyard? Oh, by the way, how do you think Jesus looked at Peter? Do you think what was written on Jesus' face, and of course, I'm getting a little speculative here, but let's just say what we know from the heart of Jesus. Do you think written on Jesus' face was, "I told you so"? No, I don't think so. Do you think what was written on Jesus' face was, "How could you ever do such a thing for me"? Was it unbelievable disappointment and rejection and see, you're just a miserable failure, Peter? I don't think so at all. Don't you think it was love and compassion on the face of Jesus? Verse 61 again. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the words of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So Peter went out and wept bitterly. Peter remembered the words of the Lord. If he had only remembered them sooner. And maybe that's like a light from heaven upon your mind and heart right now. That there's a word from the Lord that you might remember later. You might remember it a week from now, and it'll be to your great sorrow and pain. But if you would remember it now, if you remember it now, it would be for your deliverance. You could humble yourself before the mighty hand of God right now before you're shattered before him. Do you see the difference? So he remembered the word of the Lord, and then he wept bitterly. It was appropriate for him to weep bitterly. But friends, we know this. Peter was not without hope, because the same Jesus who said, "You're gonna deny me," is the same Jesus that said this to Peter. He said this. He said, "And when you have been restored, your faith will not fail." Isn't that beautiful? If Jesus is right about the one, he's gonna be right about the other. And Peter could hold great confidence in that. Now, verse 63. Now, the men who held Jesus mocked him and beat him. And having blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, "Prophesy, who was the one who struck you?" And many other things they blasphemously spoke against him. Now, Luke passes over the proceedings that happened right before this. How Caiaphas questioned Jesus in this nighttime trial. He just skips to the end that after the trial, the men guarding him started to beat Jesus. Luke's going to pick it up after daybreak with the daytime trial, the morning trial. Friends, I cannot tell you, or I must tell you, I should say, that I can't read those words without feeling something deep in my gut. Now the men who held Jesus mocked him and beat him. Why? Why? Do you think Jesus was trying to escape? Do you think Jesus was bad-mouthing them? Do you think Jesus was one of those uncooperative prisoners? Do you think that Jesus did anything to offend or to hurt? Do you think Jesus was, you know, cursing them or pronouncing ill words against them anyway? No. Do you realize that this is one of the most pure expressions of the gratuitous hatred that man has towards God? It's an awkward thing to talk about that, isn't it? It's awkward because we don't normally sense out in the world that man hates God. But if you want evidence to the fact that man, apart from Jesus Christ, apart from God working in his life, instinctively hates God, look at what they did to Jesus when they had the chance. When they had the chance, they grabbed him and they beat him and they mocked him. It's easy for us to think that they did this because they didn't know who he was. Oh, if they would have known he was the Messiah, then they wouldn't have done this to it. But yet, friends, in another sense, by nature, man is an enemy of God. And for a long time, man had waited to literally slap God in the face. To literally spit in God's face. because Luke doesn't tell us about the spitting, but the other gospels do. And so this is what had to happen. Omnipotence had to be held captive, and its glory had to be mocked. Goodness had to be smitten and stricken and bruised and assaulted. Omniscience must seem to be blinded. The face of God's perfect love has to be struck and punched repeatedly. Divine justice must be defied. And here's the thing that is almost the most grotesque thing about it. That while they did this, the full sinfulness of man was on display. Friends, when they did this, they were laughing. It was a game to them. It wasn't some like mournful work. Oh, the prisoner must be subdued, so go out and give him a beating. And reluctantly, somebody, okay, I have to do this. I mean, look, it's for the good of the prisoner or for our penal system or something like that. No! They thought it was a game to do this. And they found their cruelty against Jesus to be something delicious. They enjoyed it. And then they multiplied their sin. Notice what it says. It says in verse 65, and many other things they blasphemously spoke against him. Luke's giving us the condensed account. He's not even telling us all that they did. But then you know what gets me as well in this account? They blindfold him. I don't know if they hit him with an open hand or if they hit him with a clenched fist, but can you imagine how that would jar you? You could not prepare yourself physically to take a punch. You know, you couldn't strengthen yourself or get ready to endure it, but you're completely blind to it. You have a blindfold on, and they start beating you around the face. And then what do they say? If that isn't cruelty enough, with glee in their voices, they cry out and they say, prophesy, tell us the one who struck you, Mr. Prophet, Mr. Messiah. There's a man sitting across the courtyard named Peter who could tell you about Jesus' ability to prophesy, could he not? Didn't Jesus just establish his credentials in a remarkable way as a prophet? But did they care? No. They found sport in the beating. It was important for Jesus to face this abuse. Even though it was painful for him to endure, and even though it was painful for us as his followers to consider this, it was important. First of all, it was important to demonstrate that the proper reply to hate is not more hate, but love. Did not Jesus demonstrate this? Secondly, it was important to demonstrate that Jesus had an unshakable trust in God, his Father, and that God, his Father, would vindicate him, and he did not need to defend himself. Thirdly, it was important so that those who are abused and humiliated will find refuge in a God who knows exactly what they have experienced. Spurgeon said this, I must also call him victorious. His persecutors could not make him give way to anger. They could not destroy his mercy. They could not slay his love. They could not cause him to think of himself. They could not make him declare that he would go no further with his work of saving sinners. Now that men began to scoff at him and smite him and despitefully use him. Friends, that's victory. And Jesus displayed it all. Verse 66. As soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council, saying, now again, on the night of his betrayal and on the day of his crucifixion, Jesus actually stood in trial before one official or another several times before different judges or councils. And the order of events to this point can be summarized. First, he was brought to the home of Annas, the ex-high priest and essentially the power behind the throne. Then he was sent over to the home of Caiaphas, the one who was then the sitting high priest. And there he was placed on trial before an ad hoc gathering of the Sanhedrin still during the night. And they brought forth many false witnesses to try to accuse Jesus, but they all contradicted themselves and the case was falling apart against Jesus. So in an act of desperation, Caiaphas, the high priest, he looked at Jesus in the eye and he said this, "Are you going to tell me, I demand that you tell me if you are the Son of God?" And this is what Jesus replied in that nighttime trial. It's recorded in Matthew chapter 26, verse 57, where he says this. "It is as you say. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think?" And they answered and said, "He is deserving of death." And then after that, the beating that's described in Luke chapter 22, starting at verse 63, happened. The beating that we just described. Then, verse 66, as soon as it was day, the Sanhedrin gathered again. Now, why? Why would they do it again? Because the night trial was completely illegal. Completely illegal. The Jewish people at this time had a very advanced sense of legal system and a system of their courts and all the rest of it. That's why it says in verse 66, "The elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led them into his council." You see, their own laws and regulations were so broken by the night trial that they felt like they had to put some kind of, you know, fix upon it. You see, for example, according to Jewish law, all criminal trials had to begin and end in the daylight. And the second trial was necessary because they knew the first one was the real trial, but it had no legal standing. You see, according to Jewish law, only decisions made in the official meeting place were valid. This was held at the home of Caiaphas, the high priest. So it was at their council and it was invalid. According to Jewish law, criminal cases could not be tried during the Passover season. According to Jewish law, only an acquittal could be issued on the same day of the trial. If you were going to find the man guilty, you had to wait a day to allow for feelings of mercy to arise in the judge. According to Jewish law, all evidence had to be guaranteed by two witnesses, and they had to be separately examined, and they could not have any contact with one another. And false witness was punishable by death. And according to Jewish law, a trial always began by bringing forth the evidence of innocence for the accused before the evidence of guilt was ever offered. None of these were followed in the trials of Jesus. So now, at verse 67, Caiaphas is essentially going to recreate what happened the night before. He's going to sort of put a veneer on it. Forget the false witnesses. They don't even bring them in. They didn't do any good in the first trial. So now he's just going to cut to the chase like he did eventually in the first trial. He says this, verse 67, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. Hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God." Then they all said, "Are you then the Son of God?" And he said to them, "You rightly say that I am." And they said, "What further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." In verse 67, Caiaphas presents the same question, the money question, so to speak, that he asked Jesus in the previous illegal night trial. Plainly saying, "If you are the Christ, tell us." The first thing Jesus said in verse 67, "If I tell you, you will by no means believe." Wasn't this the perfect answer given the circumstances? Jesus had already been tried and found guilty. Jesus knew, and everybody knew, that this trial was only for a show. It was a show trial in the purest expression of it. The end was already predetermined. They were going to give him a first-class trial, followed by a first-class execution. That was all there was to it. And so he said, why am I even answering this? If I tell you, you will by no means believe. But then he says this in verse 69. Hereafter, the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. Now, this was essentially the same answer that Jesus had given the night before. Jesus warned them that even though they sat in judgment of him now, he would sit in judgment upon them later with a far more binding judgment. You know what? If you like to underline words in your Bible, can I suggest you underline one word there in verse 69? Underline that word hereafter. There's a lot bound up in that word. Because with that word, Jesus directed their attention to the age to come. Hereafter. You know, guys, you seem to be in control right here, don't you? You seem to be able to do whatever you can. My bloody lip, my bruised face, I've been smacked around mercilessly, the spit in my beard, all of that is evidence that you guys think you can do whatever you want to me, and by all appearance right here and now you can. But let me tell you something, we're not just playing for this present moment. You better think about hereafter. You better think about the age to come, because in the age to come, each one of you is going to sit before me in judgment. You, Caiaphas, what are you going to say to me on that day? Annas, the power behind the throne of the high priest, what defense are you going to make before me? All you religious leaders, the man you railroaded, abused, beat, and spat upon, then he will sit in judgment of you hereafter. Friends, we almost have something in miniature that faces every man and every woman who hears about Jesus Christ and his great work for them. It feels like they are in judgment of Jesus. I mean, it's inevitable that it would feel like that. That's exactly what it felt like here. It's as if we tell somebody about Jesus and who he is and what he's done for them. And it's like, okay, we want you to make a judgment whether or not you're going to yield your life to Jesus Christ. Is it going to be thumbs up to Jesus or thumbs down to Jesus? It's as if Jesus on trial before each individual human heart that hears about him. And I understand that and I get him. But if you were to pan the camera back, who's really on judgment? That individual. You and I are on judgment before Jesus. You know this story, it's kind of a preacher's illustration. It's been used a dozen different ways, expressed in different things. But a man stands before a painting of one of the great masters, Rembrandt, Da Vinci, whoever, Michelangelo, whatever. He's standing before the painting of one of the great masters, and he's looking at it, and being an untrained, uncultured man, he's kind of like, yeah, no, I don't really care for it. And one of the people there who works at the museum, they come by and they say, sir, that painting's not up for judgment. It's you who are up for judgment. You see, his opinion of the painting didn't say anything about the painting, but it said everything about him. That's how it is for mankind today. People who reject Jesus really doesn't tell us anything new about Jesus, but it tells us everything about that person who rejected him.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. There's a secure option to give right on the homepage of enduringword.com. you can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at enduringword.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.